Have you seen me dice bag?
The Grognard Files.
Hello, my name is Dirt the Dice, and this is the Grognard Files podcast, where we talk bobbins about tabletop RPGs from back in the day and today. I'm coming alive from my den for the second part of Dungeon Crawl Classics. Yes, this is picking up all the bits that we didn't quite cover in the first part. You shouldn't see this as a supplement. You should see it more as a DCC annual. I think I've got this, have I? It's got a different cover. In this episode, I'm joined in the room of roleplaying rambling by a resident rules lawyer and DCC zealot, Judge Blythe. I hide behind the Games Master screen and roll on a table, apparently at random, and explore some of the different versions and iterations that belong to the DCC family. One of the versions of DCC that we've been enjoying in recent months is the Lankmar campaign. It's based on the works of Fritz Leiber, and I'm joined in the Zoom of Roleplaying Rambling by Dave Patterson, host of the Frankenstein's RPG podcast. He shares his enthusiasm for the Sword series, starring Fefford and the Grey Mouser, and adds the series to the Appendix G, the never-ending list of inspiration and recommendations. Blythe is back towards the end for us to reflect on some of the RPG concerns that we've got going on at the moment. Things that we're preparing and things that are concerning us right now and the role-playing game experience. I'll be back at the end with a few parish notices and words of thanks. Until then, ramblers, let's get rambling.
Gamesmaster screen!
Welcome to the room of role-playing rambling. And we're up in the attic. Hello, I've got Judge Blythe with me. Hello, Blythe.
Hello, Dirk.
I am up in the attic. It's been sweltering recently, but there's a low wind blowing through the rafters. How have you been doing?
I've been okay.
I'm okay. Let's get straight into this. Because what we're going to do is look at Dungeon Crawl Classics. You're still fervent in your belief that it's an amazing
game? I'm still a fully paid up cult member. I played recently. I was invited to play in Andrew McDonald's DCC game in Fanboy 3, and I had a great time playing a wizard.
Yeah, you've got that dull look behind your eyes as though you're under the thrall of some wizard, some malign force.
Well, my wizard did have a malign force as his patron, so he's a rather dubious character. But I had a lot of fun playing it. It was very, very good. Enjoyed it. So, yeah, I'm not, you know, you said, I think when I got into DCC, you said, oh, I think it's just a fashion thing. And it's not, is it?
Yeah.
I'm still fervent.
It's a wonderful belief, yeah. Still. Okay, I'm going to erect this Games Master screen in front of me. Is there a Games Master screen for DCC?
There's a few. There's lots. They do a lot of Games Master screens. I mean, maybe that's part of it for me. You know, I like a Games Master screen, but there's loads. They do loads of them. They do one for every version of it, I think.
And so what's on it? Because you still...
I don't know. Because it doesn't matter what's on it. No Games Master screen ever has anything useful on it. And if it does have anything useful on it, you forget to look at it when you're playing. You end up looking at the rule book and think, that table's on the screen. Why did I not look at it? That's irrelevant. The reason I like a Games Master screen is because what I like is a hostile psychological barrier between me and my players. Some people would say, it's just a piece of cardboard. What I would say is, no, it's a barrier between me and them, the great unwashed players. There you go. I love it. I love a Games Master screen. The bigger the better. Don't have to have anything printed on it at all. Just a piece of cardboard would do, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
With barbed wire across the top.
Well, I use this one to hide my secrets because on the other side of here, I have a table that I'm going to roll apparently at random.
All right.
Choose your dice. What dice should it be?
I'm going to roll a D14.
D14
in true DCC style. The D14.
Okay. Here it goes.
Roll it. Never stop bloody rolling. You'll be rolling around forever, won't it?
Here it goes. Oh, and up first we hit DCC, which we talked about last time, didn't we? We talked about the mechanics.
Mm.
But this was on the on the table because you've got a new book, haven't you?
Pretty sure. I've got the Dungeon Denizens book, the monster book. They produced a monster book. There are monsters in the game, obviously, but it's a expanded monster book, which is really good.
So what does it give you?
It just gives you like 500 monsters with pictures of all the monsters and all the ideas for scenarios and all the stats and this, the monster book. But it's, I think as we've discussed before, you can't really beat a monster book, can you? As a supplement to a game, a monster book is really good. And I suppose in a way, I don't mean to criticise the cult of DCC, but I suppose it's been lacking a bit in that, weirdly, because the core rules has monsters in it. As you have enough monsters to play a game, you know, there's enough monsters in there. But a lot of the monsters come through the adventures. So when you buy an adventure, there'll be some different monsters in. So you kind of build up a compendium of monsters through the modules, whereas this book...
Does it bring together the monsters that's appeared in the modules?
It might do. I'm not sure, actually. That's a good point. I didn't really spot anything, but it could do. But I think there's lots of new things in there as well.
So 500 monsters, is it pushing its luck? Has it got an antelope in it?
It's not got antelope in it, and it's not got a giant badger, I don't think, either. But it has some weird stuff in. Yeah, there's obviously weird monsters. I think there's like I was looking through it the other night, a mirror golem or something, or a mirror golem, where it's like a humanoid figure, but you see your own reflection in it, that kind of thing. There's kind of weird stuff where you look at it and think, oh, this is odd. But then that's DCC. In some ways, I think it works with DCC because DCC can be so gonzo and crazy at times that having crazy monsters doesn't feel like they're pushing the luck because it feels like it's an integral part of it. Some games, it feels like they're pushing the luck because the monsters, when they come up with these kind of extreme examples of a monster, sometimes it feels like they're pushing the boundaries of the game. They don't quite fit. But with DCC, it does kind of works because it's almost like anything goes, really.
Yeah, monsters break the rules. That's all right, is it?
Yeah.
So normally when you've done this, I'm right in thinking that you've run the modules, haven't you? So is that what you've done so far? Run modules?
Yeah, I've run some modules, yeah.
But you've not created your own stuff, have you?
No, not really, but I mean, I've kind of tweaked some of the modules quite a bit.
But does this mean that buying the Dungeon Denizens?
I think it might do, yeah. I'm tempted to kind of just make you want to kind of write your own adventure, really, so that you can use some of these monsters. Yeah.
So what's your approach going to be? Is it going to be like a mega dungeon? Or
I wouldn't make a mega dungeon. It'd be like a one-shot, wouldn't it? You know,
yeah.
Let's face it, you can't expect people to play these games for months on end. But as much as I'd like to. But yeah, probably going to be a one-shot. Maybe for Greg Meatish, we'll see. We'll see.
The Maze of the Mirror Golem. Something like, yeah, Maze of the Mirror Golem.
You need a catchy title, don't you? Catchy title.
You can have that one.
Thank you.
Okay, let's go back to the table. Oh, I've got Lankmar. Mm. DCC Lankmar. Yeah. So we played a campaign of this.
We did a little mini campaign of it.
Mini campaign, but it's quite substantial. We played it for longer than our 10-session rule, didn't we?
Yeah.
And just talk us through that. Was that a series of modules? Or was it adaptive?
Yeah,
it was
a series of modules, but I kind of tweaked and messed about with them and used them as a kind of basis for a little campaign because they do sort of run together. I think that's one of the things with DCC. The modules do, you can go from one to the other and link things together perhaps more than in other games. But yeah, they were like, was it the Ganglords of Lankmar and then a couple of others where I sort of tied it together. It's quite easy to do because in Lankmar, there's a couple of things around it. But the first thing is because it's a city campaign. You're in one place, aren't you? So it's easy to get embroiled with other NPCs who might lead to other adventures. There's a sense of continuity to it. But also you've got something where you've got that carousing table. So they have a carousing table, don't they, in there, which we rolled on. And that generates some adventures, doesn't it, with... You get into trouble, basically.
Yeah, it's like a downtime thing, isn't it? So between adventures, yeah.
Yeah, well, what it does, what's interesting at a Lankmar one, I'd say all the ones we may talk about during this conversation, Lankmar is the least sort of messed with, if you know what I mean, the least meddled with version of it. So it feels very much like normal DCC, doesn't it, I think?
Yeah.
To a point, although... Fortunately, they get rid of clerics. So there's no elves and dwarves. It's like that. So all you've got is warriors, rogues, and wizards. That's the only three character classes you've got. But a lot of it, and you have a thing called fleeting luck. So you get luck points that you can burn rather than your own luck.
And the wizard spells work differently as well, don't they?
Not in DC, not in Langmar. They do in Dying Earth.
All right.
But they do a little bit. They do slightly in that what it introduces. The differences that it introduces in Langmar are spell stipulations.
Yeah. I think that's what I was referring to, because it kind of makes it a little trickier.
Yes.
To cast spells. So that
gotcha.
You're not, as a play character, you're not going to get to the level of like some of the great evil sorcerers that you get in our stories.
Yeah.
You are kind of inhibited a little bit by these stipulations.
Yeah, I suppose it kind of tones down the magic a bit in that sense, that the spells are still the same, but to cast them, you have to roll on a spell stipulation table that gives you like a... you've got to do, like, there was one where your wizard needed assistance from someone else to cast it.
Yes.
Or you've got to, you know, there's like daft ones where, you know, your wizard's got to be naked or something like that, or got to be outside, can't cast it inside, or you can only cast it inside, or you can only cast it during the day, and only cast it during the night. That kind of thing is a change from normal DCC. Yeah. It's not quite like Mercurial Magic. Mercurial Magic's more about side effects of a spell, isn't it? In normal DCC. Whereas in Langmar, it's more about what you have to do to cast it. It limits, I suppose, makes it kind of interesting as well, doesn't it?
And it also weaves in to the lore, the patrons. No, they're not just like random patrons. They are from Langmar.
Yeah, they're from the, like the Yubel of the Faceless, whatever. Yeah, and all that kind of stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. So I felt as a magic user, part of that Langmar world, but it seemed slightly odd because as a player character in that world, the main characters don't use magic. In fact, they turn their face away from magic, don't they?
And I suppose that is something in the Langmar box set, that the magic, there is magic, but there's less magic. It's not as many magic items. It's all a bit rarer, isn't it? And wizards are kind of strange and corrupted slightly, aren't they? More so than in normal DCC. So, yeah, it tones down the magic a bit. Yeah. That's one change. I think the other changes in it are, like, there's rules around luck, isn't there? So you can burn luck and stuff to heal, because there's no clerics, so you can do heal yourself and by using luck points and that kind of thing, having a bit of a rest as that kind of thing going on. But also you get your luck back. Normally in DCC, only rogues really get luck back. You do get it back, but it's quite tricky to get it back. You might only get a couple of points after an adventure, you know, if you've pleased the gods or something like that. Whereas in the Langmar, you could potentially get it all back, but what you have to do is roll on a carousing table. So between an adventure, you pick a dice. The bigger the dice, the higher your potential result on the carousing table. And that determines how much luck you get back. But you have to put up with the result from the carousing table, most of which involves things like gambling debts or being stuck in prison. The higher the result, the better, the more luck you get, but the worse the result is. So I think one of the higher results is you might get 2d10 luck back. You after a drunken night out, you wake up on the sacrificial altar of a cult waiting to be sacrificed, which generates its own adventures. Yeah.
It's very tempting, isn't it, to lean on the word gonzo, and I'm not going to.
Yeah. It's the G word.
It does have that madcap sense to it.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
That anything can happen.
Yeah.
However, it is within the frame of Langmar and the Langmar stories. I think it does a good job of emulating.
It does a really good job. And it like you say, it is gonzo, but it's reined in with the Langmar one, and it's a little more, what's the word? It's not pedestrian. That sounds really, really bad to say it's pedestrian, but it's a bit more
grounded, isn't it?
Ground, that's the word. Yeah. Less gonzo, more grounded. The G word. Yeah. Less gonzo, more grounded in the, there's a bit less magic, and it's more about getting into trouble in a city and the criminal element of it with the Thieves Guild and some of that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
plays into it.
It does a really good job, I think, with the artwork, the maps, the cartography that you
shared,
in conveying a sense of like Mar. But also, as you say, like the Thieves Guild and some of the different factions that operate in the city, they're there, but, you know, to come back to our lore is Snow.
Yeah.
You don't really need to get embroiled in all the different factions, motivations and what have you. They're just there and you're...
They're just there and you might interact with them or not.
You're almost, as PCs, you're almost NPCs in a larger narrative that are going on around you.
Yeah.
That you kind of cross into every so often.
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
like,
exactly.
You know, you might pick up a box and be chasing a skeletal hand through the city.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And it might not involve, I mean, there was one where you had to steal an elephant's head from a tavern, didn't you? And replace it without anybody knowing. It was quite a lot of fun. Like a heist, but it was a heist where you had to take this head. We were spoilers as to why, but you did find out why, but you were given this job of stealing a behemoth's head from this tavern where this ritual was going on, but replacing it without anybody knowing. There were no monsters involved, but it was like a bit of a caper, wasn't it? A bit of a heist kind of caper where, you know, you were trying to do this and get away with it, but it didn't involve monsters. It didn't involve a dungeon. It was very, it's like an urban setting.
Yeah.
You know, and they do a good job of that, because I think I've always kind of struggled a bit with urban adventures. You know, they can sometimes be a bit problematic, can't they? Because you don't quite know what to do, or you sort of feel, well, if player characters do this, this and this, is that not going to bring the city guard down on them and that kind of thing? But the Lankmar setting is such that I can get away with that kind of stuff because it's that kind of setting, isn't it?
Yeah, I got a sense as a GM, I suppose us as players got more out of it than the Waterdeep campaign that you ran.
Yes. Yeah. 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 Well, I did see a funny comment once about Lankmar on, that's just a Reddit, one of these daft sites. It was somebody complaining. They'd bought the box set of Lankmar, they bought it, and they said, "This is outrageous. This is just a rip-off of Waterdeep. What are Goodman Games thinking? This is just the same thing as Waterdeep." And you go, "Oh, no. Honey, really? Honey, is that what you think?"
Okay. Next up, we have Dying Earth.
Dying Earth, yeah.
Now, I was looking forward to this, but I never actually got it. But you'd have thought me as Jack Vance fan, I'd be all over it. But at the time, it was really expensive to purchase and get shipped. So did you do the Kickstarter?
No, I didn't do the Kickstarter, but what I did, I put in a pre-order at Leisure Games. Leisure Games are doing pre-orders so that when the Kickstarters arrived, you know, the retail ones, put pre-order in. And I got a... I don't think I didn't pre-order it. I got the old email notification that it's available, and then fastest finger first, I got a box, you know, ordered a box set. So
you've got the box set. Have you got the booklet as well, the rule book? What do you get?
Yeah, the box set. I think, as far as I know, the box set contains pretty much everything. So there's a rule guide to it, which gives you the different rules and the way it changes the system. And then there's a setting book and an adventure as well, and maps and things like that. So you get pretty much everything in the box set. I'm not sure, you might not get the Games Master screen though. Shocking, I can't remember now. But yeah, you get everything you need in the box set. So yeah, you don't really need anything else.
Is it well served with modules? Because you played a couple.
Yeah, they produced quite a few modules for it. They produce quite a few modules. The modules are quite good. They do capture that kind of Vancian flavour quite well.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, the one I played certainly had that.
Yeah, with the pilgrims, wasn't it? The funnel one with the pilgrims.
Yeah, it's a while ago now, but I seem to remember having a troop of pigs.
It was like the pilgrims of the Black Obelisk or something, where you're all going on some journey to pay homage to this weird obelisk, and it does have a Vancian feel to it, doesn't it? You know, where you're traipsing through the countryside as a troop of pilgrims, all zero level, you know, and obviously doomed to die at certain points. Yeah. But yeah, there was a pig. There was a pig in it. Yes.
There's always seems to be a pig involved.
Those pigs are chickens, isn't there?
Yeah.
It's a DCC thing. Have they got a pig or a chicken? Like comedy animals out there. You know, no one ever has. It was a sheep or a cow, and a cow's not kind of funny, is it? But for some reason, a chicken or a pig. Did that like funny? This will be funny.
So I've only played the funnel version, the zero level version of it. I played very little of it.
Yeah.
And I'm a big fan of Dying Earth, and but it's because you've not offered it very much. And why is that?
Well, I've run a funnel, and I've run a couple of proper games where you've got the character classes. And I think it is quite a tricky one, if I'm honest. I think they do a very good job of creating a Vancian world, and the character classes that they bring in are very Vancian. So you can play a Vat Thing.
Oh, yeah. So they've so
a Vat Thing. Wizards have grown them in a.
Yeah.
Play a Vat Thing, which is quite.
I always love that from Rails of the Marvelous, the fact that these growing.
Yeah,
that's different creatures.
Yeah. Play a Vat Thing. You can play a witch. You can play what's called a Wayfarer, which is like a bit of a rogue. Roguish
character. Just Cthulhu.
Yeah, about Cthulhu, yeah. Or you can play a wizard. They do say you can bring in the other character classes. But again, I'm not sure. You can bring in warriors, I suppose, but I don't think you could bring in clerics particularly. You can't bring in elves and halflings and dwarves because they're not in Dying Earth, are they? So no. That wouldn't work. I'm not sure you could bring wizards in because, again, it's a peculiar thing. But what I would say about the Dying Earth, and this came across when I ran it, I think it's quite hard work. If you ran Lankmar, DCC Lankmar, with players who'd never played DCC, or they'd played DCC, but they'd never played in Lankmar, that would be fine. It would work. It would be fine. I've done that, and it's quite easy. People get it. The rule changes are not huge. They're just enough rule changes to make it a bit different, but nothing too worrisome. Nothing to keep you, you know, occupy your mind too much. I think what I found with the Dying Earth one was, it was one of those where I thought, do you know what? I think everyone needs to have read these rules to play it, because even if you've played DCC, it changes a lot of the rules. The character classes are quite different in the way they operate. So they have a lot of abilities, which are very Vancian, but quite tricky.
I think the trickster, I think I looked at that.
The Wayfarer.
The Wayfarer.
Yeah.
And it is like a trickster type.
It is a bit like a con man, isn't it?
Kind yeah. Of
thing. Yeah.
And that's got some additional rules around it, hasn't it? That
well, the main different rule in it, and it's quite a good rule, is a thing called a grudge token.
Oh, I remember
that. You get grudge tokens where you can make other players fail their roles, because the idea is you're all slightly, like in Dying Earth, you're all slightly vain, slightly arrogant people. Yeah. Who don't like other people's success. So you can actually make players, other players fail roles.
Yeah.
Which is quite funny.
Which is funny, but it's one of those things.
You need player buy-in. Yeah. Make sure you got player buy-in. Yeah. Player buy-in. Yeah. We all agree.
Well, let's just say that and move on.
Yeah, let's just say that. And if you don't get player buy-in, no, don't bother playing it. So I don't buy into this, so I don't bother playing it.
Anyway,
but one of the peculiar things about it, and I think it's just really odd, is that obviously Vancian magic, we all know about Vancian magic, don't we? Fire and forget.
Yeah.
D&D.
Well, that's Gygax's interpretation of Vancian.
That's his interpretation.
Yeah.
Of course. All right. But what DCC does, the original game, is it goes against that, doesn't it? Because it's not fire and forget, it's roll on the table, and maybe you forget it, and maybe you don't. But of course, in Dying Earth, they bring in a fire and forget system for wizards. And you think, well, it's really odd, this, because the whole joys of DCC is you got rid of that and now you bring it in. So what you do as a wizard, you get a spell and you roll on the table. Whatever result you get, that's what happens when you cast it. And when you cast it, it's forgotten.
Yeah.
So it's like a weird inversion of, we invented a game that got rid of the stupid D&D thing about fire and forget. But now we've created the Dying Earth. We've had to retrofit our system to be fire and forget. It's like weird. I can understand why they do it, because you would have to, because that's Vance. That's sort of the way it's perceived to work. It's an odd thing. But I think Dying Earth, it's very nice. It's very good. It is very Vancian. They've done a good job of creating that atmosphere. But I would say it pushes the original game in directions that make it more complicated or different So if you think you know DCC, when you play Dying Earth, you'll think, oh, hang on, there's things here that I don't, you know. Yeah. The way witches work with the curses is all, again, a bit unusual.
Yeah. I think in Vance as well, it's kind of missing the point, because they won't get their hands dirty, would they, magicians in...
No, they wouldn't really. They wouldn't be wandering around adventuring. Yeah, that's true, actually, isn't it?
Yeah, they tend to be... They have an elevated status in their own mind.
Slightly aloof characters. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. They'd send the VAT things out to go and do the dirty work, wouldn't they?
Yeah. And it, like an Ars Magica kind of model.
Yeah. Probably the most complicated and the one that bends it and twists it a little bit.
It strikes me that the Dying Earth element of it is the modules. And I think that's what I tried to say that.
Yeah.
Last time, that it feels to me that it's the modules where the magic is for DCC. They're just well prepared, aren't they? Well produced and well thought about.
Yeah, well produced, and also they're useful, aren't they? They're useful pieces of RPG paraphernalia, in that you can grab hold of one of these things, read it, and then run it. You know, there is a lot to be said for that. Sometimes that's quite a rare thing, isn't it? Because a lot of companies nowadays produce campaign books or things that's great if you've got the time and you've got player buying. Those DCC modules, two sessions.
Yeah.
Sometimes one, maybe you relaxed about it, two sessions.
Yeah.
And you can run an adventure pretty much as written. That's about with it, baby. One.
I'm going to surprise you. You were asking whether there's going to be more coming up.
There are more coming up.
Right, come on.
Roll the D14.
Oh, I've hit an 8. Mutant Crawl Classic.
Ooh, yeah.
So this is the homage to Gamma World.
It is really, yeah.
It's a different take, post-apocalyptic, but it's still got fantasy elements to it, hasn't it? And where the magic is replaced by mutations and artifacts.
Yeah, it's like crazy science, isn't it? So it's that crazy post-apocalyptic thing where you can play like a manimal, can't you? An animal. Yeah. Or you can play a plant. Is it a plantian? It's like a plant humanoid. Or you can play a pure strange human. And then it's got sciencey, weird science stuff in it. Some of which is like science, where you think, all right, yeah, that's a bit like science. And other bits where you think, that's just bonkers. That's just like magic.
It's a fun game, I'd say. I've not played it a lot.
No.
But every time I've played it, I've enjoyed playing it.
And I think that is the strange thing about Mutant Crawl Classics. I've seen, read things where people are a little bit critical of it. They feel it's not quite as good as DCC or quite as fleshed out as DCC. But what I would say is, I think it plays better than it reads.
Yes.
So you look at it and say there's like pure, one of the character classes is, that some of the character classes are pure strange humans, and they don't seem to have as many abilities as the mutants or the plantioids or the manimals who get special mutant powers. On the face of it, you look at it and think, why would you want to play a pure strange human? But what it cleverly does, it has rules about understanding and using technology and how AI and robots and things respond to you. And if you're a pure strange human, the robots respond to you in a more positive way than if you're a plant-like, because they don't acknowledge you. They won't acknowledge that kind of thing. So when you actually play it, you realise it's quite cleverly positioned in terms of these character classes. Though they do work. You've got to make roles to understand technology. So if you find a laser pistol, you've got to make a role to understand it. And if you're not a mutant, you've got a better chance of understanding it.
You realise as well that those artifacts are key to the game, aren't they?
They are, yeah. They're a big part of the game. So your mutant might have powers, but when you encounter some robot, the robot is more likely to shoot the mutant. It's been designed to acknowledge humans. I kind of like it. I do like Mutant Crawl Classics. It's. I mean, you think DCC's Gonzo, but I mean, that's Gonzo, the capital G, isn't it?
Yeah, and it is less grounded. It is one of those where it gives the players a bit of license to have fun with it.
Yeah.
And it's a bit tongue-in-cheek.
Yeah.
The scenario I played, I think it's Atos, the one with, it's really Zardos.
It's Zardos, isn't it? Yeah, Zardos. It's Zardos, yeah.
But thanks to Roger Court, I brought together the idea of Zardos with Famine in Fargo. So I brought together an old Gamma World scenario with that. Yeah. and it became Nando's. So it was Nando's Big Chicken.
Oh, that's right, the Big Chicken. I remember I played in it.
Big Chicken Head.
It is like Gamma World, but I remember having Gamma World back in the day and never really getting on with it. Because it's, what I always thought, Gamma World seemed a bit silly. But what I realise now is I don't think it was silly enough. Maybe some of Gamma World still felt like it was trying to replicate a post-apocalyptic world. Mutant Core Classics isn't. It says there's been a great disaster. It's just bonkers.
The thing I most enjoyed about getting it was realising that it had some late Russ Nicholson artwork in it. So
yeah.
It's worth getting just for that, I'd say.
Yeah, but it's a fun... I think Mutant Core Classics doesn't get quite as much love as it deserves in the DCC community, I would say.
Let's have a final roll on here.
Okay.
Oh, it's X-Core Classics. Now, we did talk a bit about this last time when we had Brendan. And so this is just to remind everybody, it's really the running man in a dungeon, isn't it?
It's futuristic. I read somewhere someone said it was set in an alternative 80s because they've got a president called Ronald Lemon.
Yes.
Is that Ronald Reagan? I think the idea is that the world of DCC has moved on into a future like ours, but all the elves and wizards and orcs still exist, but it's become a 20th century civilization. A form of entertainment, a blood sport, is these dungeons that are done, you know, it's like gladiators, isn't it?
Well,
the wrestling thing, that's what it is. So you create characters who are like celebrities or trying to be celebrities in this world.
Talk a little bit more about that element of the game, which is about crowd pleasing. So there's mechanics around that, isn't there?
Yeah,
showboating.
Sure, you do a showboating role, don't you?
Yeah.
To get the adoration of the crowd.
Part of your motivation in there is to increase your chances of success by getting the adoration of the crowd.
Yeah. But what I would say, and I think that's an interesting element of it, is I've played X-Troll Classics a few times now as one-shots. But every time I play it as a one-shot, I always think it'd be better as a campaign game, which is odd because when you look at it on paper, you think, oh, it's perfect for a one-shot, isn't it? Because it's just a crazy dungeon. And that's true. So I've had fun playing it. Brendan ran a game at Expo and I played in that and it was great. But in the back of my mind, I think things like that showboating rule about getting kind of fame and all that, it's the idea it should be like a campaign where you build up your position as a celebrity and build up your wealth.
Yeah.
That's sort of the point of it. And as a one-shot, you're missing that element of it, aren't you, a bit? Because as a one-shot, it's just like an old-fashioned survive the dungeon, isn't it? That's what it is, survive the dungeon. Whereas if you played it over a series of months, it would be survive the dungeon, but also become famous, become rich, become a celebrity dungeoneer sort of thing.
Yeah.
And that element of it is sort of missing on a one-shot. And it got me thinking, actually, about all the, you know, like the Lankmar, going back to Lankmar. I think that's true of Lankmar. You can run Lankmar games as a one-shot, and I have done that, and it's been fine. But I think you're missing something if you don't run it as a campaign. So when I ran that little campaign, it came alive far more than when I'd run one-shots because of the carousing table, because of the interaction with the Thieves Guild, because of these plans and plots that you started to hatch. Maybe a lot of these kind of Dungeon Crawl Classics box sets are more about campaigns than the original DCC.
X-Crawl Classics is about touring the different cities, isn't it?
Yeah,
so if you've got a band of celebrity gladiators, take them from city to city with the stories that they take with them.
Mm.
Yeah, I agree. That would be more fun.
Yeah.
And what I like about it is that there's a certain cheekiness to it, but it's also bringing fantasy tropes that are essentially European into an American setting.
Yeah.
And it works somehow. It kind of creates its own mythology around it.
Yeah. Well, it's like the mythology of role-playing games, isn't it? In a way, it's the mythology of role-playing games sort of moved into this weird 20th century setting Because I must admit, when I heard about it, I thought, not so sure about this. Is this a bit daft? Well, it is a bit daft. It is daft, Gus is. But when I've played it, I've thought, actually, this kind of works rather well, this. It doesn't, in theory, it doesn't seem to, shouldn't work, but it does, actually, in practice.
I think it's all right to do daft every so often.
I think it is, yeah. Yeah. It's all right. And sometimes, that's one of DCC's strengths, isn't it? When you look at the original game and you look at all these, all the additional stuff they've done. That idea, isn't it, that sometimes with role-playing games, everyone can get a little bit earnest about it, can't they?
Yeah, I certainly can.
Yeah, we can count. You can get very earnest about it and very earnest when you're playing games. And there's a place for that because there's a place for those more serious games. Of course there is. But equally, there is a place sometimes for running around a dungeon fighting monsters and avoiding traps. Sometimes that can be good as well. Don't, we can have both in your life, can't we? They're all right, you know. It's okay. So I say it's okay to be a bit daft every now and again.
Yeah.
You know.
Right, I'm folding this table away.
Yeah.
I hope you got it out of your system. You do realise the rules and the format of this podcast mean that we can't talk about it ever again.
Never talk about DCC.
So I hope it's out of your system. Any last words?
I'll try not to, but I'll have to have a word with the High Priests. See if I'm allowed to not mention it again.
Have you got a death stamp yet?
Not yet.
Yeah.
No. I'm working. There's hope for me, yeah.
There's hope for you, yeah. There's hope for you, yeah. Okay. Cheers, bye then.
Bendix G.
Welcome to the Zoom of Roleplaying Rambling, where we're collecting our ever-expanding, never-ending list of recommendations from the Grog Squad. And I've got Dave Patterson with me. Hello there, Dave.
Hey, Doug. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. And so what do you want to enter into the Appendix G?
It's probably the entire catalogue, but I'm happy to enter a Fritz Leiber, not quite sure how you pronounce his name. I know that the one that we actually read was Swords and Deviltry.
Swords and Deviltry, which I think is the first one, isn't it?
I might be a little bit controversial. I'm not going to ask for MERP to be included, but I'm going to ask, maybe I'd have an alternative of the Swords of Lank, which is a full-length book, which is book five in the sort of swords series, as it were, for Leiber.
Well, I think it's Leiber because remember when, yeah, for MERP, remember, I don't even listen to that one. We did one on Middle Earth role-playing, and a special guest we had, Liz Danforth. And she enjoyed the podcast, but she was furious that we kept referring to him as Leiber, and it is Leiber.
I've actually seen a video clip where he corrects somebody and says it's Leiber.
Yeah. And I think they used to hang out. So I think Fritz Leiber was in with the gaming crowd back in the convention days, because I think there was quite a lot of crossover, particularly around where Ken Santandre and Liz Danforth were travelling around with the science fiction crowd, and the gaming group got together. Inevitably, he used to be in the bar, I think, and made friends with
them. Well, he designed a game for TSR.
I didn't know that.
They designed the Lankmar board game. So when I know we were going to sort of have a chat about what the influence was on role-playing games and everything else. Yeah, in terms of he put together this game. It was sort of a strategy board game, really, more than anything else, of Lankmar.
Oh, wow.
Amazingly.
That's amazing.
When they did the second edition of AD&D, they did a Lankmar version of it, I think, didn't they?
Yeah, and I think they've done one for Savage Worlds. And, of course, we're talking about DCC this time, so it has definitely always been there, hasn't it, as an influence. So what about you, Dev? When did you first read these? How did you come across them?
Well, as you can probably guess, obviously it's not on video, but the state of the books that I have in front of me, I've had them for donkey's years. And I think I was reading them before I got involved in any kind of role-playing. And I remember being completely captivated, I think, by, oddly enough, I thought because his name was Fritz Leiber, I thought he was European. Until eventually I got a book that said, the best living American fantasy writer, which was a surprise. because I think the sensibility in there, I think his language is quite European, and his sense of humour in the books, I think, is quite European. So I thought it was a bit more complex than most of the fantasy I was reading. I found him before I then found things like Vance and, you know, Stephen Donaldson and all the rest of it. And I thought he was very gritty and dark, which is why I think he stayed with me for that long, because it had quite a formative period. And that was a sort of fantasy, I guess, and the arc that I was on was very, very similar to Labour.
If you're going to give a pitch to somebody who hasn't read these books, what would it be?
So obviously, these are principally about Fafford and the Grey Mouser. I think the pitch would be, if you like role-playing games, this is the closest you're going to get in novel and short story form. They are a distillation in novel form of how you imagine role-playing games are going to be.
Yeah, and why is that, do you think? Some of that is down to that comic element of it. The way that things get resolved in these stories is not necessarily straightforward, is it? And it kind of matches that player character experience of, let's think of a plan, and then it goes wrong.
There's almost like there is a sort of in the background, there's a Machiavellian presence, as you know, as the GM might be, that says, this sounds like a great plan, but, oh, now this is going to happen. And I think, you know, the stories will often have twists and turns, and they take it in a different direction.
Well, I came to them quite late, and the collection I've got are these ones, which have got the fantastic Jeff Taylor covers. And I think you're right. Immediately when I saw them, they kind of evoked the swords and sorcery that was in my head when I was playing role-playing games in a way that very few other novels do, really.
I think the closest ally or the closest game to Fafford and the Grey Mouser is Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay. Slightly gritty. Magic is kind of, it's there, but it's not really, it's kind of frowned upon. So it kind of works on a as a sort of a subcontext. And there are all these, this sort of dark forces are in the background. So you have the Skaven, who are all underground.
Yeah.
And they're all warped. And you have, obviously, Warpstone and everything else. And you have gods that are a little bit involved, but a little bit removed. And actually, they really don't care about you. And you have these sort of elder presences that are out there. You're kind of trying to survive in a slightly more gritty and realistic environment. And I think that the closest corollary to Landmar is Old Empire. It's not so fantastical in terms of what the heroes can do. The books lend themselves to role-playing, and role-playing lend themselves so well to the books, if you like.
And the background lore to Lankmar, it's a light touch. You get the sense that the Thieves Guild operates, and it's quite a complicated structure, and it involves ancestors. And if you get deep into it, those ancestors still have influence because they're undead or they've still got a presence. But it's not, you get a sense that tacitly that there's more to this city than meets the eye, and it's revealed very slowly, isn't it? Just like you would in a game, I guess.
There's a veneer of mundanity. It's seedy, it's horrible, but it's all kind of, you know, full of crime. And then, as you said, you suddenly discover, well, hang on a second, there are these sort of malevolent forces that are just underneath. And then they meet the magicians, you know, Shielba of the Eyeless Face and Ningorba of the Seven Eyes. And they suddenly are opened up into entirely new vistas, and they go and steal, obviously, the Mask of Death and these sorts of things. So there's a sort of a graduation to, okay, well, now we're going to go and steal stuff from gods, where you could kind of plot that if you started off as first level thief and barbarian, you end up as 10th level, okay, now we're battling. Maybe not battling gods, but escaping gods and stealing from them. And it happens several times throughout all of the books where they go to different planes. And it's, you know, there's the element of the fantastic in there.
But it always feels best when they're in Lankmar. I think the strongest stories are when they're in the city, isn't it? Whether that's under the city or within it. And if you're coming new to it, Swords and Deviltry isn't necessarily the best one to start with, even though it's the first one chronologically in the story. They weren't written at the same time, and some of his writing later on isn't as strong as his early writing, I would say.
It took him until, I think, the late 60s before he brought all the stories together and tried to plot them in terms of how they would have, how the development of the characters would have been. So he's a little bit all over the place. He was quite friendly with Lovecraft. You know, he's influenced by all of these people. Then he's sort of competitive with Tolkien and Vance. And you can see how the stories have kind of changed in the element of the fantastical and the element of the dark, I guess, as well. So he was kind of writing a little bit out of sync. I think his strongest book is The Swords of Lankmar. And in that is probably, as I was kind of trying to make the case for earlier on, is the closest to Warhammer Fantasy role-playing, where there is this sort of background of the rats and the queen rat or the rat goddess are running Lankmar secretly. Liber has even more of an influence over role-playing that we maybe don't take at face value.
I think it's important that it was in correspondence with Michael Moorcock that he actually coined the phrase swords and sorcery.
And even though Thafford and the Grey Mouser never don't die, although technically I guess they do because they get brought back to life on a couple of occasions. However, it's not quite as fantastical as Conan, for example, where you just know Conan's going to survive. It doesn't matter what happens, Conan's going to survive. There's always this element of, you know, as I was sort of talking about before, not necessarily the mundane, but there is an element of mortality, I guess, is possibly a better way of looking at it.
I think we commented when we did it in the book club how often one or the other of them needs to rescue each other.
And that is consistent throughout the entire canon, variously pulling each other's backside out of the fire, without a doubt.
When you were role-playing, Dave, are you a grey mouser, are you a Fafford?
I am absolutely a grey mouser. Probably the first 10 characters that I ever made, and it didn't matter what the role-playing game was. You could have looked at them and gone, yeah, grey mouser. I'm that dull. I look for the rogue, I look for the thief, the shadowy gerbil. I couldn't be bothered to move away from that. We then played, very, very rarely, play a magic user. And partly because I quite like the fact that, you know, my personal preference is for magic to be there, but to be very much in the background. And I genuinely think it's because this is where I started.
I've always been more of a Fafford. As you say, he's not Conan the Barbarian. He's a vulnerable barbarian with a soft heart and very stoical and... As we were saying earlier, he's always pulling his friend out of scrapes, isn't he?
Well, exactly. And also, you know, is a convicted ladies' man.
Yes.
Which, you know, clearly is another thing that you have in common. Yeah. But I would say that Fafford's taste tends towards the slightly extreme. Mm. So there is one stage where he starts a relationship with a ghoul and she has entirely transparent skin, which is, I would say, is a bit off-putting. But, you know, you may feel differently.
Each to their own. I always find it amazing that they haven't been adapted. They would be perfect, wouldn't they? As you said, they are serialized, so you could have little self-contained stories.
I really don't understand why, firstly, it's not more of a dominant game environment to play in. I guess it's been a bit diluted by all of the spin-off. I think it is, I genuinely believe it to be incredibly fundamental to fantasy as a genre. I think there are so many people who've taken inspiration from Liber and from Fafford and the Grey Mouser across the whole of fantasy. I would actually say as much, if not more, and this is controversial, maybe even than Tolkien. I think he's influenced it to a significantly bigger extent, but there's never been a film. There's never been a television series. There's never been a cartoon. And as you said, these stories, they work so that they are episodes.
Yeah.
You know, every single story is a brilliant episode that you could absolutely see. You know, and they've done bloody Robert Jordan. You know, the Wheel of Time versus the Swords of Lankmar. What the heck is going on?
I've never read the graphic novels.
It's Mike Mignola. And actually, they really do work well as a visual. You know, we were talking before about what would you recommend? I would say the one I've got is the Fafford and the Grey Mouser Omnibus.
It's the Hellboy game.
Yeah. And you can really see it. But visually, the stories translate so well particularly into comics, which is why I think if they made a film or a television series of Fafford and the Grey Mouser, it might quite be absolutely brilliant. I don't think Henry Cavill would get either of the roles, which would also be a bonus.
And so have you played in the world of Lankmar? Have you played any of the derived games?
Yeah, you're going to be amazed at this, but no.
We'll have to put that right then. We'll have to get onto Blithey and run DCC.
Absolutely. Yeah, I would absolutely go for DCC. I still think I technically have, because I played Wolfram, and Jeremy is sort of, you know, he really concentrates on the gritty, which is what I think is the real benefit and the grounding of Fafford and the Grey Mouser is that sort of very, very dark sort of setting.
And I've got my copy of The Swords of Lankmar here, and I've not opened it for 40 odd years, and the page is a bit brittle, but you'd maybe want to read it again, Dave.
There's a bit at the very beginning of Swords and Deviltry. The author's notes at the very beginning, his introduction, which I thought sums up the approach to these books and also to role-playing in general. So if you wouldn't mind me just reading a little bit.
Yeah, of course. Please do.
So this is from Swords and Deviltry. Book one of the saga of Fafford and the Grey Mouser, the two greatest swordsmen ever to be in this or any other universe of fact or fiction. More skillful masters of the blade, even, than Cyrano de Bergerac, Scar Gordon, Conan, John Carter, D'Artagnan, Randoc Dahar, and Andre Devoris, two comrades to the death and black comedians for all eternity. Lusty, brawling, wine-bibbing, imaginative, romantic, earthy, thievish, sardonic, humorous, forever seeking adventure across the wide world. Fated forever to encounter the most deadly of enemies, the most fell of foes, the most delectable of girls, and the most dire of sorcerers and supernatural beasts and other personages. Now, how could you not see that as the basis of the greatest role-playing games you've ever encountered?
And on that note, Dave, I think it's a great explanation of me and you, that as well.
Thank you, Fafford.
And thank you, Mouser. Thanks for that, Dave.
I'll get me caught.
Welcome back to the Room of Roleplaying Rambling. We've got our overshirts on. Overshirts. I thought it was a bit warm to put a coat on.
Yeah, the overshirt. What's the, you know?
Heading towards the girl. Oh, one of those...
Shackets.
A shacket.
A shacket. What's that? Where's that word come from?
A shattered it.
Where's shacket? What's that word come from? I've seen these for sale and I've looked at... Every time I've seen a so-called shacket, I've either thought it's a shirt. Or a jacket. And what are people talking about?
Well, if we wear these shackets, we're not going to feel the benefit.
However, sort of torture equipment. Put a shacket on you. Don't do that.
Heading towards the door. And it's time for our closing time chat. Any other business? Have you got any other business, Blythe?
Have you? You start. All right. Give me a chance to think of something.
Okay. And as you know, I've been suffering from GMitis.
Of course, yeah.
Recently.
Yeah, GMitis.
I think I found the cure.
What is the cure?
Put myself forward for too many things.
Yeah, and then you've got to deal with it.
Yeah.
Yeah, you've just got to ride it through, face it and take it on the chin.
fight or flight. Or, yeah. No, do or die.
Do what? Or die, fight or flight.
It'll cure me or kill me.
Sink or swim.
Yeah.
Well, something like
all of those
things. All those things.
All the advice. Yeah. So on the horizon, I've got, I'm going to do a Dracula dossier over 24 hours.
Yes. Yeah.
Which we'll probably talk about in a bit more detail on another occasion. That's on the horizon in November for Grog Meet-ish. I've signed up for Glorantha Games.
Mm.
So that's in Birmingham, a one-off event. So I'm going to do a RuneQuest adventure.
Well, of course you can.
You want more? I have got more for you. I've also got Owlbear and the Wizard Staff, which I'm learning Blade Runner and writing a scenario for that. But I've also, before then, we've got MorpCon.
Mm.
And for MorpCon, I've turned back to Planescape. Now, remind me, have you played any Planescape?
I've not played any Planescape, no.
Yeah. So, we talked about it before, I think, when we talked about multiverses.
Mm.
Planescape is the AD&D 90s supplement that were produced of a multiverse that you can move between. You start off in Sigil, which is this city which has got portals into these different worlds. And there's something intriguing about this setting that I really love, and I have run it several times using Old School Essentials. However, a couple of years ago, I bought the 5th edition D&D box set of Planescape.
Mm.
Yeah, which is very attractively produced. And so I'm considering using that because I've got it, I should use it.
Yeah, use it, yeah.
But blimey, there is a great mismatch between the system and the setting.
Well, it's 5th edition, and this the setting, the box set's for 5th edition.
Yes.
So it's for that
system. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you get a book that tells you all about Sigil.
Yeah.
It gives you some of the, they've got different monsters for the multiverse.
Yeah, yeah.
And it gives you an adventure campaign.
Yeah.
Adventure. So I looked at that and I thought, no, that doesn't quite fit. I'll go back to some of the old ones and see whether that they inspire me. And unfortunately, from that time where they wrote adventures, and very often they would say, no matter what the player characters do, the following will happen.
They're like my adventures now. You read it, you think, alarm klaxon goes off in your head, you think, oh, for God's sake, come on, you can't do that.
Yeah, so whatever they do to try and alter the course of actions, it's not going to change anything.
Yeah.
So these scenarios are saying, you might as well not be there.
Yeah.
But they're very appealing, those adventures, because they interact in the world in a very different way than normal D&D.
Yeah.
Normal D&D, you go down the dungeon and have a fight with a monster, don't you?
You do, yeah. That's what it's designed for, really. Yeah.
Exactly.
Mm.
And that's what 5th edition D&D is designed for.
Yeah.
It's only effective, isn't it?
Yeah.
You realise when you're engaging with the fight.
It does. That's very true. I think we've talked about this before, haven't we? I had that problem with Dragon Heist in a city adventure. I just don't think it does anything else well apart from fighting monsters or being in a deadly dungeon or something like that. So put 5th edition characters into a dungeon or some temple of evil or something where there's lots of threats and monsters and traps, and it's great. But once you stick them into other environments, it just falls apart, I think, as a game. And as a world, the whole thing just falls apart. It's just like daft. We just said daftness is all right, but I don't know, 5th edition, it does one thing particularly well. But once you move it away from that one thing, it does sort of...
But you've got a setting there that is rich and full of ideas and potential. But all that potential is the opposite of fighting stuff.
Yeah.
So how are you going to engage with the system or use the system?
Yeah.
In a fitting way. I might as well use anything. I might as well use Old School Essentials because that probably would be more effective.
Yeah, but it's a little bit more toned down, isn't it, in terms of, I mean, it's still dungeon bashing type stuff, but it's a bit more toned down in terms of the power of your characters. Because again, I think one of the problems with 5th edition is the characters become powerful very quickly. I suppose this is, again, something about comparing it to DCC. In 5th edition, characters become powerful very, very quickly. that can do lots of powerful things at relatively low levels. So one of the tricky things is when you're running adventures for those characters, people want to do those things, don't they? But those powerful things are often combat related. If you're just wandering around a city or somewhere having some interactions, that's fine. But as a player, in back of your mind, you're thinking, God, I can cast Fireball. Come on, give me a chance to cast Fireball.
Or in the case of Planescape, so one of the adventures is around stopping an unstoppable force of Modrons that are going on a march through the plains. You, as player characters, you can't stop them. So how do you resolve this? How can you deal with it?
Because it's built around combat type stuff, but it's also built around being able to defeat things. Very combat related game, but within that, you've also got this idea that you can beat things. But like you say, if you present them with some conundrum of you can't stop these things, well, what are you supposed to do with that?
Yeah.
In D&D.
There's no compromise in this game.
Do you think that's because they're trying to port it into 5th edition and it doesn't quite work? Would it have worked with AD&D? Or would it still not have worked? It still doesn't work.
I think there is a bit of a mismatch, but that's why I think old school essentials works better because it's less prescriptive, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
So you can, when I found when I was playing it, people were using their attributes in interesting ways because you've got more of rulings, not rules.
Yeah.
Whereas with 5th edition, you got less scope, I think, for that kind of manipulation. So if you're persuading someone, you've got less available to you.
Yeah.
Whereas if you're having a scrap with them, you've got loads of options.
Yeah. Mm.
So,
well, I was going to sign up for your MarkCon game, but
and you wonder why I get GMI tested, sure, now. Am I overthinking this?
But you're not overthinking it, are you? Because I think there's that thing when you're going to run a game and you look at these things, in back of your mind, there is the thing of, oh, is this really going to work as a one-shot? Is it going to work in the way I think it's going to work?
I mean, I couldn't make it play together and put a lot of monsters in it.
It's an option.
It is an option, but it's not the spirit of
it. Not the spirit of it, yeah.
It's the setting. There we go. I don't think I'll ever get a cure at this rate.
I think you're cured. You've thrown yourself into it. You're back in the game.
Back in the game.
Back on the high horse. You're back in the saddle. Yeah. You're all right.
What about you, Blythe?
I've been doing that thing of trying to kickstart in my head Pirates of Gen X, which we're going to start in September, aren't we? So the other day, I'll post this on the Roll 20 thing. I did a summary of last season. I sat down. I've been meaning to do it for ages. You know, you have to take a deep breath and go, right.
Yes.
Let's go through the notes that I made from last time. Let's do some kind of summary for everybody that's not too long-winded. Well, that probably is too long-winded because it had not to, isn't it? A lot happened. But try and keep it succinct to the point, get the key points in there, do some kind of summary. As much for me as you, because whenever I do this, we've done it, we're on our fourth season of Pirates of Gen X now, but whenever I've done a summary. The difficult fourth season, yeah. It's kind of helped me as well because when I write it down and I focus on it and I do all the bit and I look at it and I think, oh, right, okay, now, never mind the players. This has helped me focus on where they're at with everything.
Yeah.
So I've been doing a bit of that, really, and then trying to think, right, well, let's flesh out a bit of... Can't flesh out too much of it because you'll all go and do something weird or whatever you want to do. But just trying to get my head around that. It's always strange, isn't it? I know you've talked about it before where that thing of you're doing a big campaign, you have a break from it, and then it's not that I'd not looking forward to it. It's not that. I am. But there's that, like I said, there's that deep breath, isn't there, where you, like a mountain, you look up at the top of it and think, right, here we go.
It's like start
the engine from cold. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And been in the garage for a few months. The engine. Is it going to start? Oh, no. Oh, yeah, right. It's turning over now. Okay.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure where I'm going.
Yeah.
I mean, it's one of these perennial arguments, isn't it, about who should be taking the notes. As a player, I don't take notes. And I know for some people, that is like a...
Yeah.
That is terrible. Some people are just constantly taking
copious notes. I take notes, but they're like bullet point notes.
All I can hear is some games.
It's a keyboard. Yeah, it's a weird thing about me. See, when I run a game, I make lots of notes, as you know. But when I'm a player, I just make bullet points.
Yeah.
You know, I should be the other way around, really. Yeah. Why do I make all these copious GM notes that I never look at? Really, I should do copious player notes.
Yeah. But I don't take notes, but I know that everybody else is.
Mm.
And you played with me enough to know that my technique is sick. So what does everybody think of?
What does everyone think of
this? This character.
This guy whose name I can't remember.
So what's his role in all this?
Yeah.
And people volunteer their idea. And then it reminds me, oh yeah, that's right. That's how he fits.
The other odd thing about Pirates of Dreamax is, as I've said to you, when we met Mike in the pub, I think I said, yeah, almost like a swearing, a vow to you all, this will be the final season. I'm not convinced now. After writing the summary, I thought, oh, there's a lot of things went on. You've got a lot of, you got this guy, he's on your ship. You rescued him, you rescued them. That's related to that. You've got this, you've got...
We've got so many people in our low berth.
Yeah. And there's like some villains you've not really dealt with. And I think, oh, right, okay, maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. I'll have to see. I apologise. It's gone forever.
What I'd say, as a player point of view,
yeah,
we're all enjoying it.
Yeah.
We're all enjoying it. We'll never get a chance to play this campaign again.
Yeah.
So I think we just keep...
That is the danger. Danger is rushing it, isn't it? Thinking, oh no.
Yeah.
You know, I said we'd be finished for January, so let's rush it. But depends what you do, doesn't it? What you decide to do. You
know, yeah.
There are some... I suppose... When I wrote the summary and I looked at it, I thought there's more loose ends still than I imagined. Because even though you formed the Empire and got planets to agree to be in the Empire, it's quite a big achievement, quite a big part of the campaign you've completed. Yeah. There's other planets that don't want to join, that you do want to join. There's the pirates on Thieve. There's still that Jedico thing going on. You think, oh, you've got to kind of resolve some of these, haven't you? Or if you don't resolve them, I've got to think of the consequences of not resolving.
And I think there'll be lots of fun in that, because I think what we need right now, and I probably want to withdraw this at a later date.
Yeah.
But I think it's been a bit too plain sailing for us. I think we need a bit of jeopardy and threat increasing.
Okay, make a note of that.
Yeah, I do, because it's been quite exciting. And there's always that thrill, isn't there, of achieving things.
Yeah.
And we have gone through that, and that sense of satisfaction. But so far, everything that we've encountered, we've always felt like we've had the upper hand.
Yeah.
Because we're smart, and we like this idea that we...
I think the interesting thing, though, towards the end of the campaign is... And this isn't a spoiler for anyone who's not played it, but you're at the point now where you've got all these planets to kind of bend the knee to King Goleb and say they'll join the Empire. But you're not really formed an Empire. So what you have to do now, or will have to do, is take on the Imperium and the Aslan and say, we're an Empire and you're going to have to put up with us. And that's where the jeopardy will come.
Yeah.
Whether the Imperium going to say, nowhere, we're not having this, and send all the ships into the Drinaxian kind of wherever, or are the Aslan going to do that?
Yeah, and that's
Empire, aren't you?
That to me, it sounds really exciting.
And there are some interesting mini games that will come to mini games and different rules about that. You know, about how you... We're not at that stage yet, but there are some rules about how you declare yourself an empire formally to these huge powers that are on either side of you, and their reaction might be.
I'm rather hoping that you're going to dust off Mayday or Striker.
I thought those, when we played it the last season, the rules, again, I'm not going to mention any names because I'm conscious of spoilers, but there was a space battle, wasn't there?
Yeah.
Which they have little rules for space battles, which are quite good. They're like not the ship combat rules. It's like mass space battle rules within it, and that was quite good fun because there was a dramatic sense of you went to Borat, a battle of Borat, wasn't it?
Yeah,
where you went to Borat and met some other ships and had a good old space fight and some of your ships blew up, some of our ships blew up.
It felt like one of those things that we'd have done back in the day on a big table. Black tablecloth. With the hope of making a great,
great space battle
with like teacups that in it for
planets on this,
And it, the whole thing being a bit disappointing.
Yeah, but it wasn't disappointing in patch like that. No, was quite. There are some quite good little rules in there for. You know, doing stuff like that.
There are those scenes, aren't there, where they don't. They like telescope out, don't they?
So yeah, it's like a scalable thing where, right, on this session, like that one, and there have been a few others like that. This session is bigger than just you play a character. You're involved in it, but there's also a big space battle going on where they've got a bit of a fleet and you've got a fleet and you're going to clash in a sector and battle it out, you know.
As you're saying these words, Blythe, I'm getting kind of overcome with excitement at the prospect.
The prospect's forming an empire and having your own planet.
Flamboyant rides again.
Yeah.
Hey, great stuff. Cheers, Blythe.
Goodbye. I feel like I have to go to the station. Can he hang on? I would swim the ocean wide. I would cross the great divide. I would do anything for you.
My God, what have I done?
Come closer and we can taste your flesh.
Yeah. Punugui, Mugrua, Na, Kutulu, Lai, Wahang, Nagal, Fatang.
Gatsby and the Great Race. One night of horror for many players.
Available now at drivethroughrpg.com.
Thanks to Dave Patterson for adding another one onto the list of the Appendix G. If you go to our Discord, you'll find the full list of the appendix as it grows and grows. If you're interested in adding your obsession onto the list, then please let me know. I know that some people have contacted me previously with their suggestions. Don't worry, I still have them. I'll fit you into the programming at some point in the future. You'll have heard the brand new advert for the Gatsby and the Great Race, written by Paul Fricker, which is now available to purchase updated 7th edition Call of Cthulhu version at the Miskatonic repository over at DriveThruRPG. You'll probably have heard, if you've been keeping up, that we ran that scenario at this year's Grog Meet, which was a tremendous success and an amazing experience. So it's great to see that the supplement is now available to buy. At a recent book club, we looked at The Man in the High Castle by Philip K. Dick. At the meeting, Paul pointed out that Philip K. Dick probably has more influence on his scenario writing than Lovecraft himself. And of course, when I think about how Gatsby works with its mind-bending realities and multiple layers, and I think, yes, of course, that's where it comes from. There have been some brand new patrons joining us over at Patreon over the past couple of months, and I know I did say that I would call out some individuals this time and thank them, but I'm going to leave it till next time if you don't mind, because I've got a bit of a croak. Rest assured, you'll get a mention next time. We're extremely grateful for anyone who puts a tip in the tip jar, past and present, because it's what keeps this show on the road. It keeps us motivated, pays for all the various overheads that come with it. It also supports our side projects, it gives a boost to the Discord server, and makes sure that we continue to invest in content. And thank you for listening. If you do get a chance to pass it on to somebody you know, be really grateful. Last weekend I went to Glorantha Games, and somebody said to me, I only found out about your podcast because somebody I know sent me an email with a link on. So, if you can think of anybody that you know who would like to listen, then please pass it on. We haven't had a review for a while. I don't want to sound too desperate, but, you know, please. One of the projects we've got on the go at the moment is a gladiatorial arena league. It's about to open, and Monday night is fight night. And I think next time, when we meet, things are going to get a little savage. Until then, adios, amigos.